Blog Talk Radio.
He is the last of his kind. All that remains of a once powerful nation. Some think he is a myth. Some believe he is the chosen one, who will bring balance to a world at war. And some will stop at nothing to destroy him.
Talk Live 100. I'm your host, Sohaka Amana L. Bay. And today's broadcast, we're going to deal with how to get your loved ones out of prison. This is a very, very important broadcast. We're going to need you to follow these instructions that we're going to lay out for you tonight. We got a ton of information for you. But my first thing I want to say here is it is very important, especially today with what we got going. For those of you who don't have my free articles, you need to contact me at tahaka99@yahoo.com, and I can get these things to you as an email attachment. That's tahaka99@yahoo.com, and I will rush that to you. Also, we're going to it is vital at this point if we're going to do what we're attempting to do now. You need to get with me in regards to this library. The way you access that by simply by contacting me by telephone. Area code 904-303-9061, and we'll rush that right to you, okay? So without further ado, we're going to go ahead on and get on this.
I saw an aircraft, like a tiny silver drop, entering the sky above Hiroshima. I instantly recognized it as an American plane, as no Japanese aircraft could fly at that altitude at the time. It was just one plane, so I assumed that it was passing by as usual.
And I was counting. Ichi ni san.
I was wiping the desktop. That was when the bomb was dropped.
It took about 45 seconds from the time the bomb left the airplane until it exploded. And I think there wasn't a man in the airplane that wasn't either timing it with his watch or counting or doing something. I was sure the bomb was a dud. I was sure it wasn't going to work.
Thank you.
After falling for 43 seconds, the time and barometric triggers started the firing mechanism. A uranium bullet fired down a barrel into a uranium target. Together, they started a nuclear chain reaction. Solid matter began to come apart, releasing untold quantities of energy.
There was a white light in the window, a flash, white like magnesium.
The bomb delivered its destruction in stages. The flash came from a giant fireball 300 meters wide. I was astonished. It was a startling light. Even if you had your back turned to it, you felt the shock go through. Right to the center of your brain. At the same time, any area of skin that was exposed became very hot.
Heat.
Such burning heat. Temperatures directly below the fireball were 4,000 degrees Celsius. The heat rays left shadows. Ladders, railings, even people left their outlines on stone and metal. Anyone in the open air was either vaporized or turned to carbon in an instant. At the same time, the flash sent out powerful infrared radiation and gamma rays. These could penetrate walls and attack the cells in human bodies.
Then
I slowly opened my eyes. And for the first time looked in the direction of the light. Just at that moment, a mushroom cloud appeared. People who saw this in Hiroshima are nearly all dead by now. There is barely anyone left now who can say they actually saw it happen. A fraction of a second later came a powerful shockwave which moved at the speed of sound. It turned everyday windows and walls into shrapnel.
As soon as the blast hit, I was thrown across the room. My body was flung from wall to wall and from the ceiling to the floor. My body was thrown around like it was a ball.
A jet-black belt of cloud came towards me. It came from there over...
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I wanted to play a segment from August the 6th, 1945, when the particular species of people on this planet unleashed a bomb that murdered in cold blood over 200,000 people from a single blast, and then after that a continuous death and destruction, because the people later went on and died with radiation poisoning and other things. I want you to firmly fix in your mind that the same species of people are the same ones that are holding your loved ones in prison. Make no mistake about it. There are many, many things said, and they try to make you think, well, they're there because of this, and they committed this evil and this atrocity. But I want you to understand that the bomber that carried that plane carried a particular species of people. These particular species of people are the ones that dropped that bomb and murdered those people. And you will discover after investigation that 95% of Japan's population were civilians in Hiroshima when that bomb was dropped. And that means that there was nobody there fighting them, and the men were out in the Pacific. So if you have a species of people that's willing to do something like that against a person of color, you have to begin to realize that if you're going to deal with them in a fight, you know what you're going to have to do. Now, when it comes to prisons inside the United States and our people, the people of African descent have something at their disposal that they can use. You have to understand that we have over 60 million people of African descent inside the United States, and all of them, every last one of them, those who are on the outside of the prisons walls and those who are on the inside of the prison walls are all victims of denationalization. Denationalization is a crime that ranks with genocide and treason, one of the highest crimes in the history of this country. And in previous broadcasts, I've already told you all, and the Grand National Chairman has already told you also, that you should go back and look at the movie called Amistad. And they were released from prison because they were able to prove jurisdiction. And I'm going to, for those of you who have family members in prison, I want you to go ahead and get their birth certificates and look on the birth certificates of that child or uncle or cousin or whichever family member he or she is, and look at where it says race, and you should see something other than Moorish American there. So that means that we have a person inside a prison that is a victim of not only being incarcerated, but also a victim of denationalization. Okay? Now, we're going to get back to this, and we're going to start working on how to get them out. But I have to go on to the next thing. And don't forget, it is vital that you send me for your free articles, the 14th Amendment Exposed, as well as the Commerce Game, so I can get that information in your possession. If you're new, then you need to have this stuff in your possession so that you can study it, know what you're up against. Once you've done your homework stuff, then you're ready to do what you have to do in order to get your
love. Something caught my eye the other day. Pat Robertson, the high priest of the religious right, had some startling things to say about drugs. I really believe we should treat marijuana the way we treat beverage alcohol, Mr. Robertson said recently. I've never used marijuana, and I don't intend to, he said, but it's just one of those things that, well, I think this war on drugs just hasn't succeeded. The reason Robertson is for legalizing marijuana is that it has created a prison problem in America that is well beyond what most Americans imagine. He's right. Here are the numbers. The total number of Americans under correctional supervision, prison, parole, etc., is 7.1 million, more than the entire state of Massachusetts. No other country comes even close to our rates of incarceration. We have 760 prisoners per 100,000 people. Most European countries have 1/7 that number per capita, so it's adjusted for population. Even those on the high end of the global spectrum, Brazil, Poland, have only 1/4 the number we do. Now, if you say this is some kind of enduring aspect of America's Wild West culture, you would be wrong. In 1980, our rates of incarceration were 1/4 what they are now. What changed was the war on drugs and the mindless proliferation of laws that have created criminal penalties for anything and everything. If you don't believe me, listen to Pat Robertson again.
We here in America make up 5% of the world's population. but we make up 25% of jailed prisoners. We have now over 3,000, the number must be much higher than that, but over 3,000 federal crimes. And every time the liberals pass a bill, I don't care what it involves, they stick criminal sanctions on it. And so we have the jails filled with people who are white collar criminals.
In the past two decades, the money that states spend on prisons has risen at 6 times the rate of spending on higher education. In 2011, California spent $9.6 billion on prisons versus $5.7 billion on higher education. Since 1980, California has built one college campus. It has built 21 prisons. The state spends $8,667 per student per year. It spends about $50,000 per inmate per year. Why is this happening? Well, prisons are a big business now. They are privately run, they have powerful lobbyists, and they have bought most state politicians in America. Meanwhile, we are bankrupting our states and creating a vast underclass of prisoners who will never be equipped for productive lives.
Okay, those were some of the statistics that we need to be concerned about and need to understand. Now, you also have to understand that the United States of America, one of the Jubilee brothers, we have Jubilo, Jubilee, Jubilo, and Jubilum. Now, Jubilum has never been without its slaves. Other countries around the world have outlawed slavery, turned it loose, let it go, concentrated on doing other things. But the United States of America, this particular species inside the United States of America, has never been without their slaves. They go from one slavery institution to another and continue to live like a vampire on you, sucking your blood in order to live. They refuse to let you go as being a slave. So, but they have been too greedy because they have denationalized you, and they do not have a proper jurisdiction, but it's up to you to prove proper jurisdiction. So what we are asking all of you to do is, number one, get your birth certificates. Number two, we're going to need you to contact me and access in this library so we can get you out from under their jurisdiction and prepared to do the fight that you're going to have to do. We're going to teach you how to use the contract law system, how to use the blast letters, and who to send it to, and what to tell them in there, and get ready for what you have to do. Now, once it comes to the denationalization thing, there is no win. The birth certificates are a smoking gun, but what we have to do is we're going to have to understand the ins and outs and the mechanics of how to go about putting this system in motion and getting the job done. What I need you to do, I need you to contact the person, your loved one that's inside these institutions, and have them put in an envelope and mail to you all documentation that they have in their possession with their names, which appears in all capital letters. We're also asking you to tell them to send, if they got the original arrest record and that information, send it to you. You make copies of it and send the originals back to them, okay, so that we can have the entire thing laid out for us, because, number one, the original arrest was made by private contractors. They had no standing in law. 9 times out of 10, the inmate was never taken to a magistrate's office. So we have kidnapping, aggravated kidnapping, and the private contractors carrying weapons. We have attempted murder. So we'll start there. We'll lay that as an informal conditional offer and acceptance, and we'll also mail copies of this. This is a notarized affidavit. We're going to mail copies of these things to the sheriff, the mayor, the governor, And I let them know also within the, in that letter that they have also, you have evidence that they are also victims of denationalization, because we're talking about our loved ones, which are of African descent. The birth certificate itself is a smoking gun. Anytime you walk into a courtroom, the court considers you dead. But when you walk in there and you present your documentation that contains a copy of that certificate of live birth, then the court has a very, very serious problem. But before we do all of this, let's get into our estates. Let's get out from our jurisdiction. And we're going to deal with all of that once we get ready to commence to engage in the release of our loved ones. These are very, very important steps, because keep in mind that I've already told you that the major issue that we're going to have to wrestle with, and it's not going to be a whole lot of wrestling if you do it right, is jurisdiction. That's why it was so important for us to encourage you to go back and watch the movie Amistad. Now, the Grand National Chairman has already went inside the behind the prison walls and had over 30 inmates released using the proper knowledge and proper tools. And some of these people were on death row. You see, it's all about commerce. That's why I keep encouraging you all to send me an email so that I can get you a copy of my free article, Commerce Game and How to Play in the 14th Amendment Exposed. You just send your request. Just say, well, Ty Hawker, let me have those free articles. And I'll send them right to you by email attachment. You study that. That'll give you some insight. Then you contact me in regards to the library, the area code 904-303-9061. We get you in there, get your estate set up. You're ready to go to war, okay? And it's just that simple. And as we go along, we point out different things, make sure all the T's are crossed and all the I's are dotted, and then we can begin to move forward in having our loved ones released from prison.
So in Florida, they are considering greatly expanding their private prisons, turning public prisons into private prisons, so that these corporations, some of which that are based in Florida, will make more money. Now, they say, of course, it's to save money, but we'll get to whether that's true in a second. First of all, they want to privatize every state prison south of Orlando. That's 30 facilities, and that would be at least 20% of the state's correctional system. And Chris Kirkham has an excellent article about this in Huffington Post, and you can read for yourself what's happening there. Now, private prisons claim that they do things at a lower cost. But one of the ways that they do that is they cherry-pick the prisons. So they get the prisoners with the best health records, okay, at least on average, right? So they leave behind to the public the sickest prisoners, or the prisons with the sickest prison population on average, and they go, yeah, you guys take care of those, and we'll take care of the healthy ones so that our medical bills are lower. And then they turn around and brag and go, oh, you see that? Well, we cost less. Yeah, that's because you did cherry picking. And besides which, you don't even cost less despite that. And then here's another way that they cherry pick. They look at which prisons pose the least amount of violence, because that also will keep their cost down. And they say, all right, the ones that are the most violent, I'll leave to the public, and then go, oh, look at that, the public can't take care of it right. Well, how do they get away with all this cherry picking, et cetera, and playing with the numbers? Well, they buy the politicians, and of course, mainly the Republican Party. The private prison industry has contributed more than $1.4 million to Florida's Republican Party just in the last couple of years. And that's just contributions to the Republican Party. They've also spent millions lobbying key lawmakers in the state. In fact, let me give you more numbers. In just the last three election cycles, the political action committees, the executives, and their spouses at for-profit prison companies have donated nearly $1.8 million to Florida candidates and committees. So the money just keeps pouring in. In fact, the Florida Republican Party over the last decade has been the largest recipient of campaign money from GEO Group and Correction Corporations of America, the two largest private prison companies in the country. In fact, GEO is based in Florida, and they are lobbying ad nauseum and giving money ad nauseum to the Republican Party so that when they get in office, they'll give them these contracts. And they're not hiding it. When they talk to investors, both the CEO of the GEO Group and of Corrections Corp have bragged about how this is the largest procurement contract in the industry's history, and that it is, quote, an opportunity that is unprecedented and must be aggressively pursued. And how they pursue it? They pursue it by giving all the money to the politicians so they'll get to pick the prisons that are the least problematic that they can make the most amount of money from. Now, does it actually work that, in fact, these private prisons are less costly? Well, one, stuff we know indicates that's not true. Number two, there's a lot we don't know, because in 2005, they were supposed to do a report. The State Inspector General's office was supposed to get a report from the private prisons telling us whether they cost less, because that was the last time they tricked Florida into doing private prisons. They said, oh, don't worry. We're going to give you very detailed reports on how much it costs, and we're going to show you that it costs less than public prisons. Where's that report? No, I don't know. They don't have it. What? You asked the same, but wait a minute, we're about to vote on this thing. Where's the report? Conveniently, we couldn't find it. In other words, either A, they're like, they didn't do any damn report, or they did the report, it was a disaster, and it turns out they cost more than public prisons, so they buried it. So even a Republican, now this is a Republican that's opposed to the private prisons, but it's Paula Dockery. She says, quote, they have not done any true fiscal analysis on it, and I think it's really an embarrassment. Well, how about other states then, if we can't find the numbers from Florida? In Arizona, there was a 2010 report from the state's Auditor General, and it found out, shockingly enough, that state spent more per inmate in private prisons than in public prisons. Let's all say it together. Of course! And by the way, as if all this wasn't evidence enough and proof enough, there's another little trick that they do to try to pretend, at least in the short run, that private prisons cost less. What they do is, as soon as they get in charge of a prison, they fire all the workers. Because remember, these prisons exist. They're taking charge of prisons that already have all those prison guards. They fire all the prison guards. And then they say to them, okay, we will rehire you as long as, one, you work at less money, but mainly, we want to wipe out your pensions. We don't want to give you pensions anymore. Now, the guys already have the job. A lot of them are forced into taking it because they don't want to be unemployed in this terrible market, especially in Florida. So then they turn around and go, see, we hired people at a lower cost. Yeah, that's because you save money not by any kind of efficiency. You save money by, you know, destroying the pensions of those workers who are at least had something, you know, that they could plan towards retirement towards. You save money by crushing the average guy again, and you put the money in your pocket. And then in the end, it didn't even come to us anyway. You buried the report in Florida, and in Arizona, it turns out you cost more. And you took it out of taxpayers, and where did the money go? Of course, to executives who get paid millions of dollars. Well, they were smart enough, I guess, to do an investment into buying politicians. Unfortunately, best investment you could make in America.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, there we go. We got it in a nutshell for you. It's all about the dollar bill. I want you to stop concentrating on what they say was a crime that your loved one had committed. We have to understand that the entire thing is still based on the same system that it was based on in the beginning, and that is the enslavement of the people and making a profit from the slaves. It's the same system. It doesn't have anything to do with crime. It all has to do with revenue, dollars, money, because the people that are doing this are criminals. You have to understand this. I don't know any hard criminals, and I'm not talking about our loved ones that they have labeled as criminal. See, you know, when we talk about racism, we have to understand the terminology. It's impossible for black people or people who are called black people or labeled as black people to be a racist. The definition or the best definition I found of racism is when you have two groups of people or several groups of people, and one group has so much and so much control and has so much power that the other group can only react to their power. So when you see someone calling you, well, you know, you mentioned something about the truth and the way you're looking at it and the way it's actually happening, and they say, well, you know, you a racist because you are not going along with the status quo. Your position is to be a servant, my position is to be a master, and you have a problem with it, so therefore you're a racist. You have to remind them. It's impossible. You know, you can't call Khalid Muhammad a racist. What he's done is reacting to racism. He has no choice. And the society that we have been placed in the restraints that and the disadvantages and the depravity has caused our loved ones to try to survive. You see. So they are victims of a racist system. And when we start understanding these things and put these things at the forefront of our mind instead of saying, well, they say he robbed the bank and, you know, that you know he committed that crime. Well, who did he rob? The same people that we found out earlier in the broadcast that dropped an atomic bomb and murdered 200,000 people from a single blast? Think about what I'm saying to you. Okay. Now, the way I see it, and this is just my own personal opinion, y'all got to forgive me, you know. If me and you went to rob a bank, and we're going to say that I had you out, and your job was to drive the getaway car. I walked in the bank and tried to rob the bank. I can't rob it, and then the next thing you know, I get arrested. They catch me. They put me in jail. Well, if I ask you, was it wrong for me to rob that bank, and the first thing you tell me is, yeah, it was wrong for you to do that. You gave me the wrong answer. Because the right answer would be, I robbed it wrong. Because if I had robbed it right, we'd have been on going on down the road and went on to the house. Now, let me get in here and go on to the next broadcast. y'all gotta forgive me. And I'm not encouraging bank robbery. I'm just trying to tell you how to look at things in a different light, in a different from a different perspective. How can you tell me that you are righteous and holy after the murder of over 200 million people in cold blood? How can you tell me that?
Inmates at a local prison file a lawsuit claiming they're being treated unfairly.
It centers around the United States Penitentiary in Toronto. Now, the inmates claim their constitutional rights are being violated because of their religion.
News 10's Rondell Moore spoke with their attorneys. He joins us now live in the studio with the latest. Rondell?
Mark Patrice, I have in my hand the 77-page complaint document from the plaintiffs. They're suing everyone from U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder to the Federal Bureau of Prisons. Basically boils down to this. Avon Twitty and Kifa Jayalski are prisoners at the United States Penitentiary here in Terre Haute. The two claim they are unfairly being held in what's called a communication management unit. While there, they're not allowed to have physical contact with the outside world. That includes their own family. Prison officials use the unit for inmates who they believe offer a threat to the prison's safety. Now, I spoke with attorneys from the Center for Constitutional Rights. That's an advocacy group that's representing the plaintiffs. They tell me they believe their clients are in the unit in part because of their Muslim faith, which they're saying isn't right.
What I do think is that instead of relying on real evidence, what the BOP is doing instead is relying on the unfounded and discriminatory belief that Muslim prisoners are more likely than others to pose a threat to prison security.
The trial is slated to take place in a district court in Washington, D.C. Now, we also spoke with a representative from the Federal Bureau of Prisons. They say they can't comment on this case at this time. Mark, back to you.
Thanks, Rondrell. The lawsuit also involves inmates at the Marion Correctional Facility. You can view the filed complaints by going to our website, WTHITV.com.
Okay, Mo, let's take a look at the criminals.
With well over 2 million people in jail, the U.S. has the highest prison population in the world. But some are seeing the inside of a cell because dodgy judges are getting payback from the private sector. RT's Gynesh Chikan reports on those dishing out justice for a fee.
Two Pennsylvania judges have made a killing out of juvenile prisons. Mark Chivarella and Michael Conahan were convicted of receiving kickbacks for more than $2 million from the developers of several private detention centers. But the real crime, according to parents, is that these judges then sent more than 5,000 children to those very facilities for crimes as small as fighting on a school bus or posting a parody of their teacher on the web.
My kid's not here! He's dead! Because of him! He ruined my life! Do you remember me? Do you remember my son? An all-star wrestler? He's gone! He's shot himself in the heart!
Sandy Fonzo's 17-year-old son, Edward, was a budding student and sportsman when he was arrested at an underage party. Judge Chivarella locked him up for 6 months. Shortly after he got out, Edward committed suicide.
He never looked into, you know, the whole picture of the kids. Like I said, he lined them up one by one and he sent them away, shackled them, sent them to places that, you know, God knows what went on. And then he throws them back. And how does a kid deal with that? You know, my son just never recovered from it.
Eric Stefanski was 12 when Judge Chivarella sent him to jail for 2 years for scratching his mom's car while joyriding. Or this young man, who as a teenager was locked up for months for throwing a piece of steak at his mom's boyfriend.
I really couldn't believe that being accused of something like throwing a steak was all that was needed to be put away.
The case of the two Pennsylvania judges in bed with local private prisons could be just the tip of the iceberg. A recent report revealed America's largest prison corporations pour hundreds of thousands into the campaigns of governors, state legislators, and judges in the hope of advancing their agenda. And it seems to be working. The number of private prisons in the U.S. is growing rapidly.
All of their money, every penny they get, is a taxpayer dollar that they get from the government. And so what they do is they get the money from the government to house prisoners. Then they turn around and spend some of that money by giving it back to the politicians that push the laws and the policies that lead to both more people being incarcerated and more people being incarcerated in private prisons. So it's almost a money laundering of tax dollars.
They're making contributions to judges in electoral politics. It's sort of like a closed circuit. You're making contributions to people who are making the laws, and then you're making contributions to people who are enforcing the laws.
With the number of prisons, up goes the number of prisoners. The U.S. has around 2.3 million people behind bars, more than any other nation.
You've seen prison populations pretty consistently over the last three decades move up a couple percent a year. And, you know, unfortunately, as a citizen, that's not the most exciting statistic. However, when you look at it from a business model perspective for the private operators, it's clearly good news.
The good news for the prison business turned into a nightmare for thousands of underage victims of the two judges in Pennsylvania.
There's an incentive in private industry, obviously, to make money. That's what private industry is for. So there's an incentive to have more prisoners, an incentive to keep those prisoners incarcerated for longer periods of time. There's really no incentive for rehabilitation. The incentives are reversed.
The so-called Cash for Kids case in Pennsylvania showed just how reversed the incentives can be, and raise the question, with judges actually interested in sending people away for longer terms and keeping their benefactors' private prisons full, what justice can one count on? I'm Ganesh Chakan reporting from Washington.
Okay, now, once again, as we can see, the criminals, the real ones, The one who's sucking your blood is all about the dollar bill. Okay, and what we got to understand is when it comes to people of African descent, the Moors, that have been victimized by this system, we're going to have to keep our trump cards held close to our vest, and then we're going to have to work in what they was calling networking. So what we need to do is we need to come together, those of us who have whatever state you are in, inside the United States, you need to have your loved one supply you with other people that are born in the same state that they are born in, have them supply you with access to their family members on the outside so that you can put your class action together. Now, you're going to need a minimum of 12, but the more you have, the faster it works, because all of them have something in common. They're all victims of denationalization. They all have been victims of the conspiracy of enslavement. We have all the so-called officers of the law inside the United States, besides the sheriff, flogging as officers of the law, but in actuality, they are nothing more than private contractors who have abducted and kidnapped your children and held them hostage. And when you understand, when you get the breakdown on this information, you put it in your package, and you send it to the proper places. Now, the next thing that we're going to attach to this thing is what I call BLAST. We're going to get online. I need you to get the chief operating officer, the chief executive of a company called 60 Minutes News Blast, news program. Then we're going to get Nightline, ABC. Go ahead on and send that letter over there to Tevin Smiley. Send it. You know, get them all, and send all these letters out at the same time, and so that we can get on the news and explain what is taking place from a lawful perspective and a denationalization perspective. You understand what I'm saying? Then we'll send it to the sheriff and the mayor and the governor, and let them know what is going on, how much we're charging for each person listed. We're asking for $30 million in damages per year from the time of their birth up until their current age in the section in the original letter, the conditional offer and acceptance letter under contract law, per year up until their current age for the denationalization. Now, that doesn't have anything to do with what we're charging for kidnapping, aggravated kidnapping, attempted murder, any medical systems that's going on in there. We are charging for that. If they have given your child anything from the pharmaceutical industry at all, period, we are charging them with attempted murder. Okay? So we got these things going on. Now, I need you to call me at area code 904-303-9061 so that we can fine-tune this and I can show you how this thing works. I spoke to a gentleman the other day. He was from South Korea, and I asked him, I say, were you born in the United States? And he told me, he said, well, no, I was born from South Korea. I say, do South Korea issue birth certificates to you all? And he said, yes, they did. I said, now, do they have a section on there that says race? He said, yes, they did. I say, well, what do they have on your section? Do they have the United States or do they have South Korea? He said, we have South Korea. He didn't understand my questioning, but he answered my questions, And you will discover this across the nation, except when it comes to people of African descent inside the United States who have been denationalized, which is the highest crime in the history of this country. It ranks with genocide and treason. We have more people, male and female of African descent inside the prison population than any other nation on the face of this earth. So, therefore, it behooves us to go to work in order to deliver our loved ones from the system by pointing out the truth. And you can start by getting the knowledge of what you're going to have to deal with, and I'm trying to do as best I can here in order to put that out there. We're going to go a little further, and then we're going to come back to the rest of this package.
Judicial corruption is unfolding in Pennsylvania. Several hundred families have filed a class action lawsuit against two former judges who pleaded guilty to taking bribes in return for placing youths in privately owned jails. Judges Mark Fiorella and Michael Conahan are said to have received $2.6 million for ensuring that juvenile suspects were jailed in prisons operated by the companies Pennsylvania Child Care and a sister company, Western Pennsylvania Child Care. Some of the young people were jailed over the objections of their probation officers. An estimated 5,000 juveniles have been sentenced by Fiorella since the scheme started in 2002. In addition to the jailing of the youth, the judges also admitted to helping, quote, facilitate the construction of private jails. The U.S. Attorney for the Middle District of Pennsylvania, Martin Carlson, unveiled the charges last month.
These payments were made to the judges, it is alleged, in return for discretionary acts by the judges favoring these businesses, acts relating to the construction, expansion, operation of these juvenile facilities, and acts relating to the placement of juveniles in these facilities.
On Thursday, Judges Fiorella and Conahan entered guilty pleas on charges of wire fraud and income tax fraud. They're currently free on a $1 million bail bond pending sentencing. Their plea agreements call for jail sentences of more than 7 years. No charges have been filed against the private prisons that paid the bribes. Pennsylvania's Supreme Court has appointed an outside judge to review all the cases tried by Fiorella and Conahan. But the case has prompted calls for broader reforms of the juvenile justice system in Pennsylvania nationwide. We're joined now by two of the thousands of youths jailed by the corrupt judges. On the line with us from Scranton, Pennsylvania, 18-year-old Jamie Quinn is with us. She spent more than 11 months in a privately run juvenile prison camp after being sentenced by Judge Mark Fiorella as a first-time offender. Also on the line, the nearby town of Wilkes-Barre, is 22-year-old Kurt Krueger, another first-time offender. He spent more than 4 months in a privately run prison, juvenile prison camp, after also being sentenced by Judge Fiorella. And joining us in a studio in Philadelphia is Bob Schwartz. He's a co-founder and executive director of the Juvenile Law Center, which helped expose the corrupt judges and is now involved in the class action suit brought on behalf of the jailed youth's families. We asked PA Child Care, the main private jail company linked to the bribes, to come on the broadcast. We were directed to an attorney who didn't respond to our request. Bob Schwartz, let's start with you. When did all this begin to be revealed? How did it all happen?
Thanks, Amy, and thanks for having Kurt, Jamie, and me on your show. This has been going on, we believe, in Luzerne County since 2003. It came to Juvenile Law Center's attention a couple of years ago when we heard from the mother of one of the girls whom we ended up representing, a young woman named Hillary Transu, who was brought into court, found guilty, sent away for a internet parody of an assistant principal at her high school. Her mother found us, and when we were able to bring a habeas corpus petition on Hillary's behalf, she told our attorneys that she wasn't the only one who had been locked up by Judge Fiorella, that there were lots of other kids in the same situation. That was a couple of years ago, and we began investigating and found that Luzerne County had half of the waivers of counsel in Pennsylvania, of all the cases in which lawyers were waived by young people in juvenile court, Hillary had, unknown to her, signed a paper, her mother had signed a paper giving up her right to a lawyer. That made the 90-second hearing that she had in front of Judge Civarella pretty much of a kangaroo court. So she was sent away, we investigated, and last year, about a year ago, brought a petition before the Pennsylvania Supreme Court asking them to take a look at all of the cases in which kids were tried and adjudicated delinquent and many sent away without a lawyer. We thought that was the problem. That turned out to be the tip of the iceberg. When we filed, it turned out that the FBI began its investigation and found the corruption that you spoke about at the top of this segment.
Okay, now, that was a very, very important segment, and I want you to re-listen to this broadcast over and over, because what they did in this segment is they mentioned what? What did they mention? Class action. We got people, we're going to say that you in Tempe, Arizona, and we got the same crew out gathering the people for slaves and extracting revenue for taking living, breathing beings and attaching them to fictitious titles. You understand the name of the game? So that's how they're doing this. So when we before I go any further, let me say this: the second thing that you heard was that they were where? They were on the news. That's blast. They were telling it. It's being broadcast everywhere. So when we put this thing together and we start working together and realizing that all of us have the same problems in common, the United States of America has never been without her slaves. The farms start closing up. The corporations start moving in on the farms, taking over the farms. So we got all these people out there that's done working and making money off of all this land that they done stole from killing the people that are occupying the land. They came into the moors of the South, moved them out of the houses that the moors had built that they lived in, put them in the field, moved in the house, and claimed that they were the owners of the mansions of the South. How could that possibly be when prior to the 10th century, you couldn't even read or write, let alone know how to build with Moorish architecture? No, that's how it was done. So, but we control the media because whoever created history controls history, you see. So your history on this landmass has been covered up. So therefore, you can take and go to an ocean, and inside that ocean, you got thousands and thousands and hundreds of thousands of fish, and tons of these fish are very, very tiny fish. But every fish in that ocean has a name. Every last one of them has a name and an identity, and a nationality, so to speak. But when you take the little small fish and you cut his tail off, you cut his head off, you can get a several thousand different ones, and you put them all together. And you can put several of them in a can and label that can sardines, but there is no such thing as a sardine in the Creator's creation. It was manufactured by the companies that kidnapped and enslaved those small fish. There is no such thing as a Negro, colored, black, African-American, Afro-American, and there is no such thing as a white person. No such thing. This is all invented. Go to Black's Law Dictionary and look up the word white and then look at the word black. Now, when you look up the word white, it tells you what this clean, pure, driven snow and all this right here. And then come back and replay my broadcast and listen to the first segment, which clearly shows you that this particular species dropped an atomic bomb and murdered over 200,000 people from a single blast. Now, how pure is that? You see, but when we get a clear understanding, when we look at these things and put them under the microscope, take a real good look at these things, then we can start are dealing with this thing from a true perspective when we examine it. And we got another thing where we had it, well, God said we're supposed to love everybody. How you going to love everybody when you got a problem loving yourself and loving your own brother and sister? We need to get that right first. After we get that right, then we can begin to start looking at other people to love. But until you get that right, you'll never be right.
So I had no idea. The only idea I had of anything that was going on was that the girl who I was with, who is actually the one shoplifting, never received a letter of a court appearance or anything, never heard anything else about the case. So I thought that it was done and over with. I was living with a friend for a while, and I started going to school in the fall. I was 18 at the time when I started going to school. I was 17 when the incident occurred at Walmart. I was in school one day, and I was called up to the probation officer's office in the school, and there was a police officer there waiting for me, and he handcuffed me and led me out of the school and put me in the squad car and drove me up to PA Child Care in Pittston. Since it was a Friday, I had to wait over the weekend to go in front of Judge Chiavarella, so I spent 3 days in PA Child Care thinking the entire time that I screwed up, but I was just going to get probation at the worst. And I was then sentenced in a 90-second hearing. I was sentenced to Camp Adams for a minimum of 90 days, and I was never offered a lawyer, never explained my rights to a lawyer or what benefits it would have. I was just sent away to Camp Adams for at least 90 days, and I spent the better part of 4.5 months there.
And tell us about the judge, Mark Chiavarella, who sent you there, and your reaction when you heard that he pled guilty.
Shock, I guess. I mean, it was expected that he was going to plead guilty for this last week. But when all of this first started coming up, it was just absolute shock, because I had thought that I had just gotten a raw deal, that, maybe possibly he was in a bad mood that day or something. I had never thought that the scope and the scale of this entire investigation and what has come of it.
How old were you when you went to jail?
I was 18 at the time.
Jamie, how did going to jail for almost a year after your fight with your friend, how did that affect your life?
It affected me dramatically. I mean, you know, you think it wouldn't, but it really has. I mean, I've lost friends over this. People looked at me different when I came out, thought I was a bad person because I was gone for so long. My family started splitting up, and in my personal opinion, I think it's because I was away and got locked up and was, I thought, getting, you know, punished for what I had did, which I don't think I should have. And I'm still struggling in school because the schooling system in facilities like these places are just horrible. It's, everybody gets put in the same level, and it's just horrible. I'm still struggling. I'm graduating this year, and math is still not my favorite subject. I was like an AB student before I went, and now I'm just struggling with B's and C's.
You began cutting yourself in jail?
Yes.
Why do you think you started doing that?
Honestly, I didn't even know what it was until I was sent to Vision Quest. And I was never depressed. I was never put on meds before. I went there and they just started putting meds on me, and I didn't even know what they were. They said if I didn't take them, I wasn't following my program. So in my opinion, I think that it was the meds at the time. I mean, I was never medicated in my life, nor diagnosed with depression. And that's what I believe happened.
You were sent to the hospital 3 times during
yes.
that almost year.
Yeah, Chambersburg Hospital.
Bob Schwartz, the plan now, and how much representation do young people have in Pennsylvania?
Well, in most Pennsylvania counties, almost all kids have a lawyer all the time. Pennsylvania law requires all youth to have a lawyer at the time of the first hearing before a detention officer to a judge at every subsequent hearing. Pennsylvania has granted kids in many ways more rights to lawyers than many states. On the other hand, in Luzerne County, that was a right that was largely ignored. Lawyers doing their job would get in the way of this railroad from the bar of the court to Pennsylvania child care and other placements that was taking place in Luzerne County at the time. One of the things that we hope that will come out of this is that it will be much harder for any youth to appear before any judge without a lawyer in the state. Meanwhile, there are several proceedings that are happening at the same time. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court has finally agreed to hear the case. They took the case after the U.S. attorney acted at the end of January, and there will now be an examination of all 5,000 or so cases that took place in Luzerne County from 2003 forward. There are also going to be multiple civil rights actions in federal court in Scranton going after not only the judges but others who conspired with them to hurt kids like Jamie and Kurt. What happened to them should never happen to a child in the United States of America.
And the role of the police and the schools, very briefly in this, Bob Schwartz?
Well, the police were ordered to make an arrest. It really varies, in so many ways. They were obviously told in Kurt's case to bring him to court because there was a court warrant issued because he had failed to appear for a hearing that he didn't know about. They might have acted differently, but certainly the probation department and the court should have acted differently. The probation department was intimidated by the judges. They are court employees. And one of the things that the information of the U.S. attorney claims is that Judge Civarella and Judge Conahan had probation officers change their recommendations, order them to change their recommendations in order to make sure that they had enough kids to fill slots at these child care facilities.
And the child care facilities themselves? They paid the bribes.
They paid, and the federal proceedings will bring to light what their role actually was. Right now, they have not been charged criminally, but they are inevitably a defendant in every civil rights proceeding.
So we're talking about 5,000 kids like Jamie, like Kurt. How much jail time do these judges face?
They've pled and are expecting to get 87 months in federal prison. That's a little more than 7 years if the judge accepts the plea bargain.
Mm. Jamie, how do you feel about that?
It just makes me really question other authority figures and people that we're supposed to look up to and trust. I mean, Civarella has been a judge for a long time from what I know, and a well-respected one is what I thought, and I obviously not. It just really makes me question and not trust other people. I mean, if someone like Judge Civarella can do this, then it makes me believe that anyone can betray the law, and I don't know.
And Kurt, your final comment.
Well, basically, I just want to say that finally there's some sort of closure, for me at least, coming from the lawsuits from the Juvenile Law Center. There's at least a little bit of closure for me, and I hope that's the same case for everyone who's involved.
Well, Kurt Krueger and Jamie Quinn, thanks so much for being with us, and Bob Schwartz as well. I want to turn now to the commentary that alerted us to the story of Mumia Abu-Jamal. He's been on Pennsylvania's death row for more than 25 years.
With judges like these, in Pennsylvania's Luzerne County, there are 9 judges of the Court of Common Pleas. 2 of them just pleaded guilty to a conspiracy to convict and sentence juveniles to a private prison so that they could get kickbacks from the prison's builders and owners. According to published accounts, Judge Mark A. Chiavarella and Senior Judge Michael T. Conahan sent hundreds of boys and girls to the private facility and pocketed some $2.5 million in kickbacks. This was accomplished not merely because of the venal greed of the judges, but because virtually none of the children were provided with legal representation. When the Philadelphia-based Juvenile Law Center filed a petition in the Pennsylvania Supreme Court calling the county's practice of adjudicating and sentencing some 250 kids to jail without legal representation unconstitutional, the state's highest court denied the petition on January 8th. A month later, they changed their minds, vacating the denial. What transpired in the interim? Well, for one thing, the two judges pleaded guilty to federal charges of wire service fraud. Hundreds of children get socked into jail after clearly unconstitutional proceedings with no legal representation, and the state Supreme Court doesn't even raise an eyebrow. The media reports on this outrage, and the Pennsylvania Supreme Court expresses a little interest. This is the nature of judging these days, when even kids are expendable fodder for the prison industrial complex. Luzerne County is the state's 10th largest county, with just over 300,000 souls. At least 22% of their judges have admitted being corrupt in the sordid business of selling the freedom of poor children for profit. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
And we thank the Prison Radio Project in San Francisco and Noel Hanrahan. This is...
Okay, there you go. Once again, it has absolutely nothing to do with crime. It all has to do with what we call dead presidents, greenbacks, paper, money. It's all about money. It doesn't really matter. This thing is rampant, but then there's a problem in the media sector because the media needs news. Now, if the media needs news, and I want to give you an example of what I'm trying to tell you here now. I was contacted by a man and his wife, and they told me, this was last week, they told me that they were traveling down the highway, and I think he said he had a taillight out or something, and the cops turned around and got behind him, cut on the lights, and pulled him over. But this brother and his wife, they have been in the library. They were well prepared. They had the audio and video devices installed. They were ready. And they got the whole thing on audio and video. The he was asking the officer for identification. He called the watch command and all that. And they tried to maintain the conspiracy that they were officers of the law. Finally asked him to step out the vehicle, said he couldn't do that. So the officer unlocked the door, he got it on videotape, opened the door, pulled him out, slammed him on the ground, and we went ahead and got with him. They put the conditional offer and acceptance letter together, and then we got him to go ahead and create the blast letter. And it sent it out, and he said he didn't have a whole lot of time to talk with me because he had a television interview for him and his wife, and they're well on their way to put the whole thing on blast. Now, the officials in their town, they're running and looking for a hole to stick their head in now, but it's too late. They're suing for hundreds of thousands of dollars of damages, and this is the way you had to go at these folks because what they're doing is their game is about commerce, but you have to turn them tables around and let them know that we're going to hit you right there in the pocket. And also, once you get on blast, your career is ruined. You can no longer run for sheriff again. You can't run for county judge seat again. Mayor, you didn't do nothing, so we got you on blast, too, and all of that. So once you do this thing right and we put that trump card in there, and you know the trump card I'm talking about, because we are the ones with that trump card. 60 million people of African descent inside the United States are victims of denationalization, the highest crime inside the United States of America. It ranks with treason and genocide. Okay? So now... we're going to, after I do the segment here, we're going to go over with the other little fine-tooth combs and the other little things that you have to do, and then we'll recap and put this whole thing in a nutshell for you, and then we'll roll with it, okay? So just hold tight.
You're looking inside a corporate-owned private prison. It's Friday at 8 p.m. Black men are being beaten by Hispanic men. The guards, unarmed, have run away. The prison cut costs a few weeks before, and the staff with the keys to the armory were let go, except for one, and he's gone home for the weekend. Two people are about to die. Many more seriously hurt. Stockholders, investment firms, and politicians on the take are not hurting, however. Profits are way up in what many are coming to believe is a very bad business indeed.
Yeah, the new slavery, it's commerce in souls. The incentives are all perverse, and it operates on the backs of you know, human beings. The longer they're locked up, the tougher we get, the more profits, and you know, the better off these companies are.
Who's pushing private prisons? There is an intense lobby at the national level and at the state level of these corporations that make a profit off of body and cells, lobbying legislators for more bodies and cells.
They call it the prison industrial complex, and that's really what it is. It's a description of what Eisenhower was talking about 50 years ago, you know, when he was talking about the military industrial complex.
The industry leaders are Tennessee-based CCA, Corrections Corporation of America, and the Boca Raton-based GEO Group, formerly Wackenhut. They routinely pay off legislators state by state, and they provide kickbacks for contracts. A recent report from the Institute on Money in State Politics reveals that during the 2002 and 2004 election cycles, private prison companies, directors, executives, and lobbyists gave $3.3 million to candidates and state political parties across 44 states. Colorado legislator Buffy McFadden wants to stop these practices.
I can speak to a definite instance that's happened in Colorado in the past year. The number two man at the Colorado Department of Corrections was on sick and annual leave while consulting for a private prison corporation that bid and was awarded a private prison contract. The state employee, Nolan Renfro, was working on the state's time consulting for the private prison corporation.
The private prison industry got its start in the 1980s, when the get-tough-on-crime public sentiment combined with the Reagan-era philosophy of pushing off government services onto the private sector. Judy Green is a prison policy analyst.
The very first contract for the first private prison in America went to CCA from the INS. And then Wackenhut came into the picture in 84. And they got their start detaining immigrants at Aurora, Colorado.
The business was born through influence peddling.
The business people who founded CCA were very closely tied to government in Tennessee and Texas and throughout the South. The founder of Wackenhut, Mr. Beasley, had been the campaign manager for Lamar Alexander when he became governor in the state. Lamar's wife, Honey Alexander, was a stockholder in CCA right from the beginning. It was partly about political contributions, but mostly it's about hiring the best lobbyists money can buy and having those contacts to begin with, you know, being entrenched in the political system.
Corporate executives partner with lawmakers to write profit into the United States Criminal Code to put more bodies in more beds.
ALEC stands for the American Legislative Exchange Council. This is an organization that was founded in the mid-70s by the same people who set up the Heritage Foundation. ALEC takes great pride in being the generator of all of that legislation that swept the states in 1993, 94, 95.
Three strikes and you're out. Tough on crime, truth in sentencing, what they call, unquote, model legislation have boosted our prison population here in the United States to something like 2.3 million at this point, far in excess of any country in the world. Our incarceration rate is totally off the charts.
Mandatory sentencing resulted in an explosion in our prison population, and many more African Americans are jailed than whites, due in large part to the disparity in sentencing for crack cocaine versus powder cocaine. When the Democrats took control this year, this issue was put on the table, and it is getting bipartisan attention. Republican Bob Ingalls is a sentencing reform leader.
Really, we need a logical system of sentencing. It needs to be serious and send a signal to the criminal element in the country that, listen, you do these things, you can do some time. And we're serious about that. But it also needs to be fair, because if you end up with a system that isn't fair, then you undermine the whole system.
Private prison corporations approach poor, primarily rural communities, offering employment opportunities and big money handouts for long-term contracts. However, protests on behalf of labor are increasing as wages and jobs have been cut and conditions for workers have worsened.
Well, the industry has always made the argument that they can deliver better services at a lower cost and save taxpayer money.
They come in there and they say, we're going to have these wonderful jobs, we're going to have benefits, you know, it's going to be great pay, living wages, and we'll pay a lot of taxes, and we'll bring all these other businesses down, like motels for the visitors and the prisoners. And it's all essentially lies.
The communities that take the prison find themselves saddled with the idea that they are a prison town, and that's not attractive to other, you know, businesses. The very thing that attracts these towns to prisons is not attractive for long-term economic development.
The GEO Group has had a contract in Pueblo, Colorado for 4 years. They didn't even break ground. They were holding the state hostage, asking for guaranteed financing or guaranteed beds so they could go out on the open bond market to get better financing. They wanted to have a 90% occupancy rate. And to GEO Group, I asked, where's the free market? Where is the free market? The state should not have to guarantee your profit margins to your stockholders. That's not the business of a Colorado taxpayer.
The latest growth opportunity? These same firms have been awarded immense contracts from DHS and ICE. And now they're rounding up families. Last month, the grassroots organization Texans United for Families protested at the T. Don Hutto facility in Texas.
The prison is now being operated as a quote-unquote family facility. There are 400 people there. 200 of them are children, mostly mothers and their children. The children are dressed in prison scrubs. They're being housed in prison cells. They're being offered an hour a day of education or recreation. I mean, these kids are locked down. And just like with the criminal justice crackdown, the Get Tough crackdown, you know, which was going to solve the problem of crime in America, what it's going to do is create a whole new market for a lot of people to make a lot of money, and that's a very unhealthy thing. This distorts a very important and complex area of public policy that needs to be thought through.
Did you see this is the new director of the Department of Corrections?
Oh, nice.
Hi.
Malia.
How are you doing?
Malia Brooker.
Good.
We're talking about private prisons.
Oh, let me out of here. Let me out of here. I'll talk to you later.
Shameless.
Okay, so now, what do we have? We have the Moors engaged in a titanic struggle inside the United States against international, well, I can't say international, but national extortion. This is extortion. We kidnapping. Aggravated kidnapping, assault, battery, and the list goes on and on. Your loved ones are being murdered inside these facilities, and they are treated no more than just like chickens in a slaughterhouse. I want to talk to you now about something else because we are moving toward the close of an age. We're going to be experiencing an economic collapse. I put a website on advertisement, and it's a company where that you can go on and they have like night vision equipment and a special type of binoculars that you can use and see in the dark. When you're out hunting and you have gotten your weapons and stuff that you're going to use in hunting, when you're hunting at night, you need to mount these special infrared scopes and night scopes on your weapon in order to capture the animal that you're going to hunt and kill for food, and you're able to see them. It's very, very important that you get some of these things, even if you don't get it nothing but a pair of binoculars. You can do that. But if you are able to afford to get one of those night scopes to mount on your rifle that's very, very important. That way you can hunt successfully when you are out hunting in order to get food. Also, I'd like to encourage you all to go to my website after you have go to Facebook on my wall, and after you have visited this website, you go to my wall. I have placed other videos there that you need to consider as well. I put those there this morning for you to examine them and to check them out. But I put that there for a very important reason as we move to the collapse of the economy inside the United States. Keep in mind that the United States has never been without a slave. They have no intentions of setting you free. So therefore, it behooves us to take all necessary precautions to survive, because that is the first law of nature, and to put food on the table. So when you purchase all your hunting rifles, most of them come with day scopes, but you also need to get night scopes as well, so you can change those. You can get special binoculars where you can see in the dark. That's very, very important for you to have. So I wanted to put that there along with the information that we're putting here for you today, so I can include that for you. Now, for those of you who have loved ones incarcerated in prisons inside the United States, we want to understand and listen very, very carefully, because it is important, it is vital for you to contact me in regards to this library, because there are things that have been put there for you to put in place before you begin to tackle the situation of actually relieving your loved ones from the hostage situation. Everything that we're talking about now involves your preparation for getting the job done. We don't want to go at this thing half-heartedly. We want to make sure that we succeed at what we are attempting to do.
California prisoners are suing to end torture of long-term solitary confinement. This is a really fascinating story, and it basically started last year in 2011 when thousands of prisoners at Pelican Bay State Prison in California went on a hunger strike, because it turns out that 500 of their prisoners have been held in solitary confinement for 20 years. I'm sorry, for a decade. But there are 87 prisoners who have been held in solitary confinement for 20 years.
Yeah.
It's an incredible story because, and we've talked about this before, solitary confinement is supposed to be used for the most violent, dangerous criminals, right?
Mm-hmm.
And in a lot of cases, they put inmates in solitary confinement for ridiculous things. We did a story about Lil Wayne. When he was in prison, they put him in solitary confinement because they found an iPod. He was listening to music, he got caught, and they considered it contraband, so they put him in solitary confinement. Look, I get that he's not supposed to have the electronics, but solitary confinement is not for someone who wants to listen to music.
Mm-hmm.
We overuse it. Our prison system has gone way too far.
I don't know enough about the day-to-day operations of a prison to say, in particular cases, if they're overusing it. Like, if they put him in solitary confinement for 6 hours or something, maybe he hadn't been responding to other forms of punishment. I'm just playing devil's advocate here. I do think that it's interesting. If you have 500 people in there for a decade, we don't have explanations here of exactly what those prisoners have done before or after being put in jail. It's possible they'd had multiple violent, you know, incidents at jail. And at that point, I think it becomes an interesting question of what exactly do you do with these people?
Mm-hmm.
If every time they mix with other prisoners, they're becoming violent, what do you do with them? I mean, you either put them in solitary, or, I mean, do we put them in a chemically induced coma and just let them ride out the rest of their life that way?
Look, that's a difficult question to answer, but the question is, is putting them in solitary confinement helping the situation? Because when you put someone in solitary confinement, it totally damages them psychologically.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at prison systems, like, for instance, you know, we talk about prison systems in Europe, and Cenk and I have gone into great detail about that. And when we compare it to the system here in the United States, we see that the recidivism is much higher in the United States. We do nothing to rehabilitate these people. In fact, with private prisons, we purposely make it so they come back to prison, because there's a profit for that. Now, in this case, it is a state prison, so it's different. But putting 500 prisoners in solitary confinement for 10 years, I mean, that sounds like a bit much.
Steve?
Yeah, one of the main reasons for doing that is not because they're violent people that need to be sequestered. It's because they won't do favors for the correctional system. So, for example, if they ask the prisoner, hey, we want you to rat out on this other guy, and he doesn't do it, solitary. If they say, hey, we want you to be an informant and infiltrate that rival gang, and they're afraid because if they get found out, they're going to get killed, solitary.
Solitary confinement sounds like the worst thing. And just to give you guys more insight into what solitary confinement is, they will be in like this tiny little room with no window, nothing. It's just, you know, concrete walls for 22 hours a day. And they get to go to another concrete room for about 90 minutes to exercise. And then they get placed right back into that solitary confinement. It's the scariest thing. And again, we're doing nothing to rehabilitate these people because we're not concerned about rehabilitating them. Prison is all about punishment in this country. It's about punishment and profit.
Okay, there you have it. Punishment and profit. It is about the dollar bill. So, this is some very, very informative information that we're putting down here, and it behooves us, and I want to encourage you to listen to this broadcast more than once before you begin to do what you have to do. And keep in mind, once again, it's vital to call me. Area code 904-303-9061 before 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time so that we can begin and we can start. Okay, we got to start. Don't worry about what you ain't got and where you ain't at and all that right there. Let's start. I'll tell you what all you need to do, where you need to concentrate on getting things done at, and what you need to start doing immediately. Okay, but let's go ahead and start first.
In our last video, where we were talking about liens and slavery under the straw man name, the all caps name, we stopped on this issue. I had mentioned that I'd been hearing an unrebutted affidavit stands as truth. What most people don't tell you is that most attorneys will not respond to an affidavit. So whenever you file a complaint, whenever you do the instrument lien process, you always want to include an affidavit. Now, as I mentioned, I've been hearing that an unrebutted affidavit stands as truth. I know now, because I've spent the last hour and a half doing research on it, that an unrebutted affidavit stands as truth. I have proof now. So what I will do is I will provide you that proof. This law here, it says the Court of Appeal may not assume truth of allegations in a pleading which are contradicted by affidavit. Okay, so that can kind of lead a person to say, well, that's your proof right there, but that's not the proof. Here is the proof. We have here, well, let me explain what I had to do. I had to take that statement, and I had to continue with that statement that an unrebutted affidavit stands as truth. So here is a court case with a gentleman named Poole. And it says, his claim is sufficient pleading to satisfy the pleading requirement of Rule 32. This is obviously an Arizona case. It says, and his factual allegations were unrefuted by the state. Therefore, they must be accepted as truth. And then it mentions Bass versus the state. And this was done in 1992. When the state does not respond to a petitioner's allegation, the unrefuted statement of facts must be taken as truth. Then it lists Smith versus state in 1991. In addition, his claim is not precluded by any of the provisions of the rule. Because his claim is not barred, is sufficiently pled, and is unrefuted by the state, Poole is entitled for an opportunity to prove his claim. In other words, they couldn't dismiss this case. And I guarantee you, if you go back and look at this case in the original court, you will find that the very first thing the prosecution did
is ask for a motion to dismiss. The judge went along with it. He appealed it. The appeal court reversed that decision. Why? Because not only did he have an affidavit, but he alleged the affidavit fact that it had not been refuted. And an unrefuted affidavit stands as truth in law. It's a maxim. I just needed to find the maxim. And so you have three cases here, the Poole case, the Bates case, and the Smith case. Now, let me explain why this was important, why I needed to do this. Every last one of my complaints that have been filed, the last 10, I always include the word affidavit. There is always an affidavit attached to the complaint, or I make the affidavit part of the complaint. Why? Because the affidavit stands as truth. I knew the maxim, just never knew where to find it. So here are three cases showing that. None of the attorneys have ever responded to a single affidavit in a single case. However, in the UPS case that I continue to mention to all of you, the attorney provided an affidavit from someone who had no knowledge of the case. This is just somebody who works for UPS, who is aware of its tariffs and rules, but he had nothing to do with the case. I responded to that affidavit, and I refuted every single point by point, line by line. Why? Because an affidavit must be refuted point by point. You'll see that in a minute. Now, this is one case. And to let you know, I did a Google search on unrefuted affidavit, but because I'm not online anymore, this is the Court of Criminal Appeals of Alabama, and this is Poole versus State. And again, this was the final decision of March 2007, but as you saw the date of the case, it was earlier than that. The Bates and Smith case was 1991, 1992. So this is the Poole case, 2007. So apparently this pro se litigant did his research. So his name is David Lawrence Poole, and he appeals to the circuit court and summary denial of his Rule 32. So basically he filed a petition. When you sign a plea agreement in the state of Arizona or Alabama or any other state, and it's a federal Rule 32 that you are allowed to ask for post-conviction, after you've been convicted because you signed a plea agreement, relief. Well, Poole asked for post-conviction relief, and they denied his claim. The only problem is he did an affidavit with it. And because of him doing an affidavit, it couldn't be summarily denied if the affidavit wasn't refuted. There are some other issues that they mentioned that he sufficiently pled his case. In other words, he listed all the pertinent issues. In other words, he gave the right of claim, who he was, who the defendants was. He gave the who, what, when, where, and hows. And because he did that, his case was remanded back to the state court. So the court summarily denial of his rule number 32, and that was the circuit court. I guess the circuit court is like a superior court or a district court or state district court. But it lets us know, and see, it has nothing to do with what he was originally charged for, but because he's doing an appeal of that original charge, then that's what he was appealing. If you are doing a civil case like we are, you will appeal all of the missteps, the fact that you asked for a common law trial, the fact that you made the court aware that you were reserving all of your rights and so on and so forth. This video will be a lot smaller than the other videos. This is just an update. Okay, the next case is Sharon Hayes, and she was representing her deceased husband, and she was handling the estate of Howard Hayes. Now, she's the plaintiff and the appellant because even she had a problem with her case where her case was denied. Her case was dismissed. Now, they go ahead and they explain why the case was dismissed and everything. And give me a second. I'm hoping it'll let me refresh because I'm not on the internet. So it may or may not. These are just pages that I've saved, and I'm trying to, as a matter of fact, let's do it an easier way. Instead of me looking for the sections, let me go ahead and pull up the sections. Note, we're going to talk about the first case. We'll come back to Mrs. Hayes in a minute, but we're going to talk about the first case that I took a look at, and this is Avery. Forgot the full name of this case, but I do know that the defendant's name was Avery. It says, additionally, Avery's claim that the trial court was without jurisdiction to render the judgment or to impose sentence because he said, although he was indicted for burglary in the third degree, he pled guilty to and was convicted of burglary in the second degree, which means that without an indictment, and you're going to see that, that's what the court ruled. It says he attached a copy of his indictment showing that the indictment was for burglary in the third degree, so he gave evidence, and a copy of the of an Ireland form indicating that Avery had pled guilty to burglary in the second degree. The state's response to Avery's petition did not address the merits of Avery's jurisdictional claim. Therefore, Avery's unrefuted claim must be accepted as true. And then it lists Bates versus State, 1992. And again, Bates is going to list Smith versus State, 1991. Now it says if the defendant, and this is still Avery, pleads guilty to an offense for which he has not been indicted, the trial court does not have jurisdiction to render judgment on a guilty plea. So when you raise jurisdiction and you do it on the onset, if the trial court has no jurisdiction, none of the rulings stand. In each of my cases, jurisdiction has been the issue, and the judge repeatedly refuses to bring up on the record what the jurisdiction is. So as I stated before, because I filed under jurisdiction of common law, I'm going to continue under that jurisdiction until another jurisdiction is stated on the record, because the jurisdiction of common law is on the record, the original filing. Doesn't matter how they changed the name. Doesn't matter how they changed the caption. They did so without doing it on the record, and thus it can't stand. Okay. Getting back to, now, here we go to the Pools claim. That's what we just read, okay? So that was that case, and as you see, everything that was in that case is here. Now, let's see. I'm hoping it will let me. Let's do a back and a back. Okay, let's do this particular claim. Like I said, I'm working with this software, but this software I kind of like. So I'll eventually adjust my accelerator, my video accelerator, and then I won't have the problem. I believe you're able to see the screen clearly, but when I'm looking at the screen, the words bunch up together because of the accelerator, and the program tells me that it doesn't work well with accelerators. But Dury plays this claim in his petition with sufficient specificity, to satisfy the pleading requirements in Rule 32 and Rule 32.6b, and the state did not refute this claim in its response to Dury's petition. Therefore, Dury's claim must be accepted as truth. Then it lists Bates versus State. Now notice, when the state does not respond to a petitioner's allegations, the unrefuted statement of fact must be taken as truth. Then he quotes Smith versus State. Because Dury's claim that he was not afforded probation revocation hearings, a probation revocation hearing is jurisdictional, is sufficiently pled, and, sorry, went too far. And was present evidence in order to satisfy the burden of proof. We believe the defendant's unrebutted affidavit meets the burden established that James, as a member of defendant's control group, the facts alleged in James' deposition and affidavit were not present evidence in order to satisfy the burden of proof. Again, we're dealing with unrebutted affidavit and how they stand as true. And that's the issue here. We believe that the defendant's unrebutted affidavit meets the burden established in James, members of the defendants. I just read that, so I apologize. It says James' disposition and affidavit declared that he was the sole director of claims of personal injury. And let's see, I think it's up here. The facts alleged in James' deposition were not challenged. You see, an unrebutted affidavit stands as truth. Why? Because it's unrebutted. Nobody can come and say, that's not true later, because it's unrebutted. They can't rebut it later. It's that acquiescing. You see, a person has to be given an opportunity to answer, stand, or acquiesce. And for the most part, most people acquiesce. Let me see if I have that law, if my website is still here. And I'll know in just a second. That's not my site. Nope. Well, maybe. Maybe I might be able to pull it up if it lets me go to it, because it shouldn't be. I'm hoping that it'll let me pull it up because it will refresh in the catch, because I haven't cleared the catch. So if it pulls up, I'll be able to show you where it explicitly says that an individual will be given an opportunity to answer, acquiesce, or not respond. Now, here's the next one. The plaintiff refutes none of these facts. We accept them as true because they don't refute it. Unrefuted facts accepted as true for the purposes of appeal. It's a maxim in law. And again, I knew it was a maxim, but I had to prove it. Because I can't just take everybody on the internet's word that it's a maxim at law. I need to prove that it's a maxim. And so that's what I'm doing here with this particular issue. I must prove that that's exactly what's going on here. Now, we have this case. Now, these two cases, this is one case right here. I just wasn't able to pull up everything. But the Hayes case pretty much says the same things as those do. Now, we're going to go to the red section. The court must treat all unrefuted allegations as true. And this is C. Stankel versus the state in 2005. When no evidentiary hearing is held on a motion for post-conviction relief, a movement's allegations are accepted as true unless they are conclusively refuted by the record. So it has to be refuted. And when nobody refutes it, it stands as truth. So when the defense attorney wants to ask for summary judgment and wants to ask that your case be dismissed, there are issues still outstanding because he didn't refute it. So if you bring up allegations that they don't refute, that stands as truth. So do not be afraid of summary judgment, because summary judgment now has to be in your favor, because there are allegations that are made that are no longer allegation. They stand as truth. And remember, the allegations must be facially sufficient to claim for relief and is not refuted by the record. It has to be refuted on the record. So there has to be a record.
Okay. We come to the close of that one. Now, let's take a look at our affidavit of truth. First, we have fraud. We have officers, policemen, acting as officers of law when they're private contractors. Then we got aggravated kidnapping. We got kidnapping. We have attempted murder, which if the officers are not policemen are not officers of law, and they've haven't taken you to a magistrate's office. They're taking you straight to jail. The fact that they are not officers of the law, and combined with the fact that they did not take you to a magistrate's office, whether they did or not, still doesn't really matter. And the fact they have weapons, we have attempted murder. So now we have a hostage, not an inmate, a hostage. You have to understand the difference between an inmate and a hostage based on the circumstances surrounding the situation. Now, the next fact, truth that we have, in our case, persons of African descent, the Moors, whose bloodline stretches all the way to the ancient Kemetans. They're calling Egyptians, which is no such thing, no such place. We have denationalization. Now, if it's up to the state and the prosecutor's attorneys to deal with these truths, they are officially, at this point, in a no-win situation. Period. You may have a couple of them do a few somersaults in there. The judge may jump up and throw his eyeglasses across the room and just wait till you go pick them up, and then we can go on and see if you're going to deal with this truth that's out there. After you get through doing the somersault, we hope you don't mess up your new suit and all of that, but just like the brother said, that we have to deal with the truth. Now, if any of you out there have any questions, now's the time to ask them. Once I see your hand raised, just follow the prompts on your phone, and we can deal with your questions or comments. At this time, we only have 12 minutes left, so go ahead and make your questions or comments briefly. And we'll try to see if we can get them answered for you. And while you are getting your phone ready to do that, I'm going to go ahead and state the fact that you should contact me in regards to your library, because in the library are the tools that you're going to need in order to get your loved ones on the path of release. There ain't going to be a whole lot of wrestling. Because I don't know if you all, if any of you are familiar with Reverend Ike, the guy that used to have the, say he's had a prayer cloth, and but he used to always have a saying that you can't lose with the stuff I use. So I would like to say if you would contact me at area code 904-303-9061 before 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and for those of you who have loved ones locked up in prison, and we can start getting the ball rolling for their release. Now, I have one a caller that is our caller. I'm going to open up the line here. Area code 954. Tell us who you are. What's your question, comment? Where you calling from?
This is Janet from Miramar, Florida. My question is, how you doing? My question is, are you saying that in any case, any time that you are put in a police car and going to jail or whatever, you must go to a magistrate office before they take you to jail?
That's right.
For anything.
That's right. Now, what we have to look at now in a situation like that, they would have some leeway if it happens during a certain time of day. For instance, after the city is shut down, a lot of cities shut down early. A lot of magistrates go home for the evening. But now, if we are, let's say 8, 9, between 9 a.m. and before the sun goes down, and these laws are actually on the books of whether certain things can be, you can be charged with certain infractions during certain time periods. But it's like 10, 9, 10, 11, 12, 1, 2, and 3, 4 in the afternoon, They got plenty of time to take you to the magistrate's office, but if they don't, keep your mouth shut and go ahead on, make sure you got all the other tools and stuff in place so that you will have you self-protected. Because remember, in earlier broadcasts, I've already told you, no evidence, no case. So we want to make sure we got all the evidence. And as far as your jurisdiction is concerned, we got that sitting here waiting on you, too.
Okay. Thank you.
You're quite welcome. Okay, so if any of you are, if there's some more of you out there got the questions and comments, come on and bring them on. We got 9 minutes left, and we can see if we can answer your question. Address your comment right here, right now. And don't forget, for those of you who are new or listening to this for the first time, if you're just tuning in, just send me a friend request at Tahaka Amana L. Bay right there on Facebook, and we'll go ahead and grant it. Now, we got area code 682. Okay. Islamo. What you got, man?
How you doing? This your brother down in Houston, Texas, man.
All right, man. I used to live down there, right down West Park and Gessner. What you got?
Hey, listen, Mo. I got a little jive time case that I'm trying to formulate the strategy to get rid of. It's a trespassing issue. Can you assist me with that?
Yeah. Tell me what you got.
Oh, it's just a trespass. They charged me with a trespass. And
all right, well, go ahead and now after I close off the broadcast tonight at 9, call me in the morning by between 8:30 and 9, and we'll talk about it, and we can get it worked on.
That's what it is. Okay, that's what we do.
All right, 904-303-9060.
Boy, I already got you. You don't remember, but I sent you that finance on the site. Remember?
Okay.
Don't worry about it. We'll talk about it in the morning.
Okay. All right. Next caller. Come on in now. We got 7 minutes. We got plenty of time to talk. So if you got something going on, or you got a comment to make, or you got a question to ask, now's your time. And for those of you who have not gotten the most comprehensive library inside the United States, contact me before 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time at area code 904-303-9061. We'll get you in there with the quickness, and we'll point out to you exactly where to go and what to start doing. And then we don't abandon you. If you have questions and comments and things that you don't understand and you're trying to do something, go ahead and contact me, because this is what I do. I do this on a daily basis, and it's all to help my people. Okay, we got area code 954. Tell us who you are, where you're calling from, what's your question and comment.
All right, this is Janet again from Miramar, Florida. Okay, now Janet. On that unrebooted affidavit, were they saying unrefuted or unrebooted?
Yeah. No, unrefuted.
Okay.
That's when you present facts and truth.
Okay. Okay.
And what the prosecuting attorneys and the judges will attempt to do is go around it and proceed on. But
okay.
They have not addressed these truths. Yeah, that
okay.
is unrefuted.
Okay, thank you.
You're quite welcome. Okay, come on, Mose, let's go. Let's do this here. Now, I've been banned off Facebook, so those of y'all who they have allowed to be on Facebook, they attack me on a regular basis. I'm hit with a 30-minute ban. I can befriend 5 people, and they say, "Oh no, we got to ban you for 30 more days for you trying to communicate with people you don't know." But even though we all got the same last name, and we all none of that don't matter. So, but it's very, very interesting to see how they do that. But I'm not deterred by that. They can't stop me. We're going to keep on going. Facebook collapsed, they closed it down. We just simply open up another door and keep on going. And so we got these radio broadcasts. We got your names and numbers down on paper, and we're able to communicate with you all up and down the state of Florida and all across the United States and in other small countries as well. We have quite a few cases where I have talked with my brothers and sisters that are actually taking what we are teaching and using it, and they are reporting tremendous success. Some of the stories are quite funny, how they deal with the government officials, the state officials, but nevertheless, they are being successful. Now, we got 4 minutes and 10 seconds left. Is there anybody else out there that have a question or comment? Go ahead and raise your hand, and I would recognize it, and then you can ask what your question or comment is. And also, don't forget, save for your free article, and we'll get that into you. Get that to you. Now, well, what I'm going to have to do now at this point, ladies and gentlemen, we're coming to the close of this broadcast, and I hope you all have got something out of it. We're going to come back later on down the road with part two after we put this thing together and see if we can go on to the next phase. But the bulk of what you need to know and what you need to use has already been given to you tonight. Even though we may have to re-rehearse it for you, we'll do that. So I've been your host, Tahaka Amana L. Bay, and until next time, you all be cool, and don't forget to contact me.